Welcome to Success Is Podcast. I'm your host, Phil Portman, serial entrepreneur, author, and podcast host. Whether success for you is more money, time with your family, a healthy, well-balanced life, or freedom, I'm interviewing guests and getting you the advice to make it happen. So join me as we uncomplicate the complicated, help you define success, and give you the strategies to make it happen. Hello, and welcome to Success Is. I'm your host, Phil Portman, and joining me today is Dustin Hendrickson. Dustin is a visionary real estate developer, investor, and founder of Mailbox Money, a company focused on creating innovative, wellness-centered housing solutions that benefit both investors and communities. With roots in the trades and a passion for turning underutilized spaces into purpose-driven developments, Dustin brings a unique blend of hands-on experience, business acumen, and heart. He's on a mission to build what the world truly needs and to do it in a way that's sustainable, ethical, and impactful. I'm excited to dive into his stories, his philosophy, and what success really means to him. Welcome to the show, Dustin.
Hey, thanks for having me, Phil. That was a very heartfelt introduction. Very good.
Absolutely. So, you know, I want to kick it off with, what does success mean to you?
Success means impact to me, and positive impact. How are you helping others, and what are you improving others around you? Are you helping others to also be successful? And then, do you enjoy what you're doing? Are you doing what you want to do?
Absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. So the mission of Mailbox Money is to address the affordable housing crisis by developing innovative, high quality, and wellness-focused multifamily real estate. So this is an important topic to me, the affordable housing, because it's a major crisis. And for those of you that don't know about the crisis that we're experiencing, I want to go through some data points and facts here. So from 2019 to 2023, median home prices in the U.S. rose by approximately 40%, from $294,900 to $412,300, according to the National Association of Realtors. Over that same period, average real wages adjusted for inflation grew by only 5.3%. This means that home prices increased in that same time period 7.5 times faster than wages annually. So there's clearly a major need for affordable housing.
Yes.
So given this stark affordable gap, how is Mailbox Money leveraging its innovation and wellness-focused approach to make multifamily housing more accessible and impactful for communities in need?
We are developing desirable housing, multifamily housing, in really safe neighborhoods. And we're doing this by primarily through design. It's designed to always be affordable. We don't do this through subsidies. I believe that a single family house is not affordable, and that the affordability is no longer in that realm. And we're also out there promoting multifamily housing as an alternative. It's not just single family housing. When you think of affordable housing, most people think of a single family house needs to be affordable, and they're trying to figure out how to do that. And I don't think that that is, I think that effort is very, it's just not sustainable. That effort is not really going to get you anywhere. And houses cost what they cost. You can't really make things cheaper just because you want to make them cheaper. Land continues to go up. Infrastructure goes up. Maintenance costs are going up. Taxes are going up. Insurance, everything is going up. So not only the median price of the home, but everything along with it, the ancillary stuff's also going up, making it even more unaffordable. And we just see multifamily housing as the new starter home. And so we're trying to produce very desirable multifamily housing that is wellness design, that makes you feel good, gives you a sense of pride of ownership, because it also looks good from the exterior. It's good architecture. It improves neighborhoods, and it's in safe areas. So everything we do is very intentional, wellness design, and we just want people to have very nice housing opportunities. And primarily when you think of affordable housing or workforce housing. That's not what you think of. And so we're trying to change that whole perception.
Yeah. No, I, years ago, you know, affordable housing used to be like mobile home parks.
Yeah.
I was watching this special the other day, and they were talking about how these investment companies have bought up these mobile home parks and significantly raised the rent of these where they're located, because they identify that these people can't go anywhere. They're stuck there. So they look at it as an opportunity with people that are stuck there to raise the rent rate on the place. And so not only are they being squeezed outside from single family homes, but then even the traditionally mobile home parks are, they're raising the rates on those as well. So this is an interesting concept that you're doing. And I think it's one that's well needed right now. A lot of times affordable housing, you can face resistance from existing like residents in the area. How do you engage with communities to ensure that developments are welcomed and beneficial to all stakeholders?
Well, it's in the verbiage that we use as well. So we don't start with saying affordable housing. We're going to bring affordable housing in. We use other words like workforce housing, attainable housing, multifamily housing. Even multifamily housing has its battles. So we have created brochures and pamphlets and different things that we use to get the economic development corporations, the municipalities on board with what we're doing. We also sell it to the residents because it's a very boutique-y feel. It's not massive apartment buildings. We use 12 to 25 unit footprints, and they're low slung. So they're a much smaller building, and then they're kind of copy and paste. They're also very attractive. It's modern architecture that has a lot of design and thought that went into it. We use really nice cladding. It's a darker exterior with a little bit of wood, a little bit of natural stone, lots of large windows. So it doesn't look cheap. It looks much more expensive than it really is to build. And then we cut out things like elevators. We have mainly surface parking, but we put that parking in the middle so it's hidden. So we promote beautiful architecture and lots of landscaping so that, and then the roofs are low slung. So it's about a 30-foot height. So it fits in almost every development. It doesn't overpower most things around it.
Got it. Yeah. How are you leveraging technology to keep your affordable, your cost down?
We don't use, our property managers use more technology than we do. We don't use a ton of technology. We keep it very simple, and we use more efficiency. Every single process we have is built on efficiency. So we don't use all the new technologies. We have a little bit, we have some surveillance, we have some Wi-Fi, we have some entry systems. We do use a lot of AI to create packets of information and to do certain things here and there. But what we've found that technology is more for the, most of the technology is used in the higher end housing. We do use a lot of technology of say like efficient building products.
Sure. Like modular construction, things like that.
Yeah. Like we use a lot of wall panels. We use higher technology on the insulation. We're trying to get more insulation to bring down utilities. That's our next low hanging fruit, is to build these even more efficient than code requires. And then to do a lot of air sealing, because air exchange is where you lose a lot of heat or cool. So there's a lot of energy transfer through air leakage. And so those are the two lowest hanging fruits we have to make these things even more efficient. So we focus more on efficiency, and we're not that much of a tech-driven company. We have used a lot of tech before, but we find that a lot of it requires a lot of maintenance and a lot of ongoing support, and that drives the costs up a little bit. So when we do a higher-end product, we'll use a little bit more technology, but we found way more demand in the affordable housing, and we've just pivoted completely into it.
Yeah. So I think you are using some of it in your modern construction materials, though, and that's
Yeah.
kind of where you're using some of the technology. Yep. So I want to hear a little bit about your background, because you started off as a roofer. Was that correct?
Correct. Yeah. Yes. Started off as a roofer. And my mom wanted to build, she wanted to buy a duplex. And this was in 03 when prices were starting to skyrocket and nothing made sense on paper. And so she's like, let's just build something. So we learned how to build and develop by doing one duplex. And we did everything, you know, two or three times trying to figure it out. We had a lot of people helping us. When you're young, people will give you all kinds of help because they don't view you as a threat and they like to be mentors. So we were able to, I was able to use that, my youth and my energy. And she was the CPA and she did all the financing and she had a passion for rentals, even though she'd never really done them. So it was kind of just a great situation. Turned out to be amazing because we added so much value. We did so much stuff ourselves. Had we kept the costs down so much, we were able to just keep doing duplex after duplex. And then I started doing custom homes, and then that led to bigger apartment buildings. And all of a sudden I got overwhelmed because I was doing too many different things. I was doing starter homes, custom homes, fix and flips, bigger apartments, smaller apartments. We did a whole neighborhood of starter homes, affordable homes, efficient homes, did modern architecture, did some adaptive reuse, did a construction project on path to how to build a passive house with SDSU. So I learned a lot in that time, but I was overwhelmed and I realized I really liked doing the larger apartment buildings. So then I've discovered syndication. And as soon as I discovered syndication, I started penciling out all my projects and I realized density was where it's at. I started selling all my single family stuff and pivoted into larger apartments and just kept going bigger and bigger and bigger. And now we've developed a plan that's really effective.
That's awesome. That's great. So you went through the housing crisis then.
Yeah, multiple ones, because there was a housing crisis in
COVID, right?
COVID too.
Yeah,
there was the big one in 08 though. Yeah, we went through that.
So how did you survive that and continue to succeed?
We did not have very much speculation going on. So I would never was much of a spec builder. It was always build it, rent it out, build the next, rent it out, build the next, rent it out, have a plan to hold. If you have a plan where you can hold something for 5 years, I've never seen a time when you couldn't make it work. So if you have a 5-year hold pattern, you can always usually make it work.
Yeah. Can we expand on that a little bit for our audience that's not familiar with what you're describing? So let's talk about like over leveraging and why people were in rough situations during that time and why you weren't.
Yeah. So if you get if you do a project, you get a 2-year loan, you all of a sudden in 2 years, you have to refinance. You have an 80-20, so 20% equity, 80% debt. Well, you didn't bring enough equity into the project to now refi because rates went down. You have to refi, you're forced to. It's not because the cash flow is not there per se. It's more because the term of your loan is running out. So now the term of your loan's running out and now you came into a bad time. Your refi actually goes lower because it's harder to sell stuff, not because of your cash flow. You can still support the loan. Now the bank wants to bring you in 15%, and you don't have 15% on every single project that you've done because real estate just doesn't work that way. Most real estate people use their money, they put it down, they move to the next project, they use their money, they put it down, and then they use the cash flow to pay for their thing as they're expanding. And they can't really handle coming back and having to pay 15 or 20% down on each property. And if you hit a bunch of properties come due at the same time, then you're going to be in trouble. And the same thing's happening now. So you could get 80-20, even 90-10 debt. Well, now all the debt's structured at 35-65 to make it work. So any loans coming due now and coming off of 3.25% or 4% and going to 6% to 8%, that's a huge lift. Because now you have to pay the debt down, plus your payments go way up. And so people are getting in trouble now. Just like in 08, 08 was much worse and much more abrupt though, because all of a sudden all the financing stopped. And we didn't have a bunch of projects that came due during that time. So that was one way that we were okay. We had more longer term loans. We were only doing duplexes, but even now we do a 5-year note on our construction. And some of the notes that we did that were 3 years, we had to struggle a little bit more with some of those. So we don't even like the 3-year notes anymore. And a lot of people will do sometimes one, but 2 and 3 year notes are very popular in the real estate industry. I don't like them because it you just get the project stabilizing off the ground, and now all of a sudden the note comes due and everything's changed and the market has deteriorated. Well, you don't have much time to pivot and make any adjustments. So I like to have a minimum of a 5-year note of construction note that turns into a 5-year kind of permanent note, until then you can build in 1 to 2 years and you got 3 years to try and change your game plan or come up with some more capital if need be.
Have you ever walked away from a project that just didn't align with your values, or just you didn't like it? And can you kind of describe what your thought process was in that?
Yeah. So we walk away from projects all the time. We try not to put a bunch of hard money into deals because of this. So we will get it under contract, start going through all the due diligence, and there's many reasons why deals fall apart. Usually it's financially. Those are the easiest ones to walk away from, because all of a sudden just doesn't make sense. So, oh yeah, this isn't going to work. We're walking away. Interest rates have went up too much, too fast. Maybe a big employer goes away, so there's not enough people to rent in that area. Construction costs rise too much. You discover something in the project, like a reduction in units. Oh, you didn't have enough parking. Now we got to take a building away. Now you don't have enough units. You know, parking didn't line up. Maybe the topography, after you get more into the civil, you need to bring in too much fill, too much retaining walls. So your costs go up, or just reduction of income. So anytime that happens, that's easy to walk away from. But sometimes you'll run into you just don't like the area anymore. You don't like the location, or something just happens. Something changes in the market and you just don't feel comfortable with the deal anymore. And sometimes you got to walk away from that. That's a little harder to do because it's all based on your judgment. And so we've done that too. But any deal that falls apart for whatever reason, it's not a big deal to me. I just feel like I'm guided in a certain way. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. I don't get too emotional about it. If you get emotional and you want to make sure you save every deal and you can't ever let any money go, you end up putting a bunch of good money after bad, because you don't want to realize the loss. So you keep going down the path and then you realize a much bigger loss.
Absolutely. You keep chasing your loss. Yeah.
Yep.
So same thing with partnerships and relationships. Mm-hmm. Deals that just didn't work out because you just didn't feel it with somebody, or is there anything that you're looking for quality wise that will turn you away from somebody? And then on the flip side of that, what kind of are you looking for when you're looking for somebody that you want to partner with or work with? What kind of qualities do they exhibit?
Okay, so exhibiting qualities, this is very big for me. You want to make sure that you're partnering with someone that's actually different than you. And a lot of times when we first get our partners, we want our best bud, someone that's exactly like us. And those are the worst partnerships, because all of a sudden you guys are fighting over who's doing what, because you both want to do the same tasks and you both don't want to do the same tasks. So these items don't get done over here, and these items you're kind of fighting over who's going to do them. And you know how you think you could do it better than him, and vice versa. So, and you know how to do that task really well, so you know what goes into it. And sometimes that's not good, because you're like, well, I could have done that in 4 hours and he took 10 hours and now you're judging him on it. And meanwhile, over here, this stuff's not getting done. So if you can get people that love doing what they're doing and you're all covering each other's weaknesses up, that's way more important than 100% getting along and being best buds with your partner. You still have to get along with them and you want to be like-minded, but you want to be also not like-minded. You want to have a bunch of different mindsets in the group. And so that was one lesson that I took me a while to learn, because I'd always partner with buddies. You also want to be with someone that has a great attitude, but sometimes you need a pessimist in the group and you need an optimist in the group as well. So sometimes just because someone's a pessimist and you butt heads a little bit doesn't mean it's not good for you. Sometimes that's really good for you too. And sometimes those struggles are good. Sometimes you need people that will be the a-holes per se, and they'll bring stuff out that no one else can say. And you might get mad at them and they might hurt your feelings, but that's not always the worst thing. So that's to that point, that's really important. And then also realizing when the partner's not the right fit and then being able to move on. That's also important. Like sometimes you're in really deep with the deal. It's like, okay, well, I don't really get along with them. I'm not going to do any more deals. How can we sell this deal and get out of it? And a lot of times it's easier just to take a little bit of a loss and move on than to keep dealing with a really difficult partner.
Yeah. So you've done all sorts of different roles in these various positions, and you know, moving from like a roofer to where you're at today. Is there any personal habits or mind shifts that had a huge impact on your success, and really, were there any that weren't easy to adopt and you know, took some struggle with you, or what has led to you as success in the role that you're in today?
Well, I do have some natural talents that God gave me, and those are important. So all glory to God on that. But also realizing that I'm not good at other things and getting help. Mindset shifts, extremely important. So starting to read a lot. I've always been curious, but when I started to read books instead of just look up articles and read magazines and more shallow, right? More shallow information collecting. Once I went and got deep information, go into books that are deep. And normally when you read books, they'll tell you the same thing 10 times, maybe in a different way, but it's repeating 10 times. Because it usually takes about 10 times before something to really sinks in. And then actually implementing those is very important. So reading books was probably my biggest shift that I can point to, like that I did, and not something that around, you know, not something that God did or a way that I got led somewhere. Reading was huge. Journaling was important, and becoming really self-aware, like taking some criticisms and not taking everything so personally and trying to reduce the ego, working on all that kinds of things, those kinds of things, which is self-development and comes with reading and trying to always get better. Also realizing that pretty much everyone's bad at communication for the most part. Good communication's a skill that almost nobody has. And so realizing that and working on that, and me realizing that I'm more logical and I need to, like, it's better if I could figure out how to speak from the heart more than my head. That's my biggest struggle currently, but I can see how huge of an impact that it could be to master that skill. And that's a huge struggle for me. Like, I can't figure it out. I'm really, really bad at it. But every day I go on this course 1 hour a day minimum. And then I go to these immersions where I'm there for 4 days. It's pretty much the hardest thing I've ever done. It seems like it wouldn't be hard. And if you're very emotional and good at having like heartfelt conversations, it'd be really easy for you. But this is one of the hardest things I've ever done. And it really makes me understand how poor I am at it, specifically just communicating through heart-centered communication and transferring emotional energy back and forth. I'm kind of on the autism spectrum, so I'm all logic based and I can be maybe awkward at times. And so learning how to be trying to be more charismatic and ask more questions about people and connecting with people is super hard. And that's, to me, that'll be a massive unlocking to the next level if I can figure that out.
That's great. And I hope the audience listening is taking away from this. He just gave you some key gems on what has helped take him to the next level. He's continuing to be a student, even though he's found success. He's journaling, he's reading, he's self-analyzing. He is not plateauing in his life. He's continuing to work on himself. And that is an incredibly successful behavior in whatever role you're in or whatever you're doing with your life. So thank you for sharing that with us. So you talk about communication, and in your world, you are, I mean, multiple disciplines, right? Like design, development, investment. How do you keep those teams aligned and inspired? And I mean, you got different egos out there and all that stuff. I mean, how do you do that?
Well, I usually just offer minor critiques to everything now. So I've done all the roles. And so now I'm just connecting who I feel is the best at those roles. And then when they bring something to me, I try to praise them, but then give them some minor critiques. Like the design stuff. I don't really do that much design anymore, but I show up at the job site. I'm like, oh, these windows should be a foot bigger here and they should be a little bit. So I'll say, wow, this is a fantastic job site. And then I'll throw in my little critique, but let's improve on this or that. And then also I learned to maybe not give any critiques. Maybe I should just sleep on it for a day and then try. And then it doesn't really even need to be said, or is it just, am I just in a bad mood? I try not to have any transference of bad energy very, very rarely, and usually only at the highest levels. Like anyone that's below, I try to make sure that I'm not overly critiquing or giving negativity, because it just doesn't really do anyone any good. But I just have a lot of experience, and then I realized that my experience is not common sense, because a lot of times you think that, well, why doesn't everyone know this? Because it comes so second nature to you. And so just having a lot of self-awareness that I'm just at a different position, a different level than everyone else, and to keep that in mind. And then to also just know that everyone has egos, and what makes me feel good is probably going to make most people feel good too. So. You know, I don't know, just keeping that all in check. It's letting people do the work, though, is very important. And then also understanding that most things don't have to be perfect. Like, you might have gotten to where you're at because you're really, really good at things. But then also realizing that you probably didn't need to do the things that good to get where you're at anyways. And most things don't really matter. And so learning how to just let things go as well is super healthy and helpful for a lot of people. But yeah, egos are very fragile. So you never want to trample on someone's ego, and you want to, if you do have to like disrupt people, you don't want to offend them too much, but sometimes you do have to offend to actually disrupt. So balance. I don't know. There's definitely a balance there. And you just, you got to make sure that, to remember, everyone's going to take things personally, or almost everyone does take it personally. So just telling them not to take it personally, that's not really going to help either. So, and maybe when you do offend them, you'd have to come back and mend that as soon as possible. So yeah, it's a delicate balance between everything, but the better you get at communication, and the more you actually don't say anything, honestly, a lot of times things heal themselves. And then if you put a really, really good example, people are going to follow your example more than you just complaining about things.
Absolutely. Well, Dustin, I appreciate your time today, your amazing advice. Great hearing your story and your journey. For our audience listening, how do they get in touch with you? How do they follow what you got going on?
Mailboxmoneyre.com. And it'll have all the ways to get a hold of me.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for your time. And to our audience, thank you for tuning in to another episode of Successes. Until next time.
Thank you.